Well, thanks for joining us again for the next installment of Haggai. If you were with us over the last few weeks, let me just sort of bring you back to the reality of what we've been dealing with. God's people were in captivity in Babylon. Babylon has been taken over by the Persians, and under Cyrus, the king of the Persians at the time, they sent back a huge cohort of God's people, about 40,000, back in Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And Haggai is encouraging God's people to get building the temple and to keep building the temple. And those are the two sort of strap lines of the first two talks, if you missed them. Get building, keep building. And we saw last week the sort of the dangers of various discouragements along the way. Keep building. Now, of course, back then, God's people, about sort of 500 BC, they were using bricks and mortar to build a physical temple. And it was a big structure. Today, of course, as we consider what that means for God's people today, we're not involved with building a bricks and mortar type of project, but we are involved in a building. We are involved in a church. We could even call it a holy temple or a house. That's the language that's being used in the New Testament again and again. We build today as we encourage people to know Jesus, a spiritual structure described in the New Testament as a house, as person by person, brick by brick, we come to know Jesus and grow up in our understanding of Jesus. So words are primary. But here, this brings us a little bit more to the issue that we're going to deal with today. My lifestyle, my actions are important too. You see, the way I live my life as a Christian, being part of this building project, encouraging others into the building project, well, the way I live my life will either adorn or undermine what I say I'm involved with. So building work is always whole of life. Words that we say and actions that we're involved in. Everything that we do matters. Everything has an impact. I don't know if you've ever thought of your life like that if you're a Christian. Every single thing that we do will either uphold, put out, somehow help the building project, or it will hinder, undermine. So as a Christian today, I build as I engage in gospel work and I rely on the Lord. And sometimes I'll be doing that in his strength, knowingly. Other times, though, there'll be times where I am not relying on his strength. I'll be using my own strength, my own motivation. I'll be going through the motions as a Christian. And that really is the issue in the passage today. The challenge, if you like, a sort of question. As we build, as God's people today, as we involve ourselves in the building of God's spiritual temple, are we relying on the Lord, on his strength, or are we just motoring around, sort of on fumes, if you like, on our own strength? People in Haggai's day, at this stage, were not relying on the Lord. Sure, they were building with their hands. Sure, the temple was beginning to sort of take shape. There was something to see. But they were simply going through the motions, and that's the issue of the passage. It's time for the first problem to be addressed. You'll see the first point on the handout there. They needed to see their inability to please God with what they do. 2 verse 10, have a glance. We see another date, the 24th day of the 9th month. Important, because it helps us understand that they've now been building for 3 months. 3 months they've been working away under the Middle East sun, getting their hands dirty, working very hard. But something's not right. There's an underlying problem. Have a look at the conclusion, verse 14. Chapter 2, verse 14. Haggai answered and said, "So it is with this people and with this nation before me, declares the Lord, and so with every work of their hands, and what they offer there is unclean." Every work of their hands. Do you see that? Everything they're doing, unclean. No lack of outward action. Lots of in sort of engaged activity. But the people had stopped relying on the Lord. And that is a serious problem, a serious sin, we might say. And they needed to be woken up to this. They needed to be brought to their senses. They were doing everything in their own strength. That's why God calls in the priests via Haggai, 2 verse 11. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, ask the priests about the law." Okay, we're being called upon, the priests are, if you like, the sort of the experts of the day. You know, in a courtroom, if you're trying to make a case, you sometimes, certainly when you watch the films, you get a sort of a ballistics expert sometimes called in, or a medical expert to give testimony, which will make the case. Well, because the matter was sin, you bring in the priests. Why? Well, because the priests were experts on the law. And so they could decide if sin was happening or not. In Haggai's day, the priests were called in to expose the seriousness of sin. And so you imagine at this stage a sort of line of priests, I don't know, some sort of cohort again, 20, 30 sort of priests being sort of wheeled in, rolling up their sleeves, carrying the big sort of scrolls of the law under one arm. You know, they were there to do business, there to give their opinion. And then the question is asked. Well, verse 12. If someone carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches with his fold bread or stew or wine or oil or any kind of food, does it become holy? The priests, you can imagine them conferring with one another, and they said, well, no, no. That's our first principle. I put it on the handout. Holiness can't be transferred. You see, after a priest offered a sacrifice, it was customary for him to carry the meat home. It was one of the privileges of being a priest. And the way that a priest would typically do that, as Haggai alludes to here, is they would, they'd sacrifice the whatever it was, the animal, the lamb or something, sacrificed on the altar. And then the dead animal, the meat, if you like, was then sort of gathered into the fold of the priest's garment. You can imagine them sort of lifting up their apron and scooping the piece of meat in and keeping it sort of safe and relatively sort of clean in the fold of their garment and then taking it home. So it's a set apart animal that's been sort of sacrificed. Take it back home and the priest's family could eat the meat. And the point was that meat, because it had gone through the sort of the process, the sacrificial system that was in place in that time, that meat was set apart. It was holy, sanctified. Question is raised to the priests as to whether or not this holy status, that's of the meat in the fold of the garment, the holy status can be transferred. For example, if the priests happen to sort of brush past a bottle of wine, does that then make the bottle of wine holy? The example that Haggai gives. And the answer, I don't think the priests needed to confer for very long. They looked at each other and thought, this isn't a very hard question. No, they publicly said, holiness cannot be transferred. I guess this is not a hard principle for us to understand. Think of a ward full of sick people, and you as a well person walks in. Does your wellness get transferred to the sick people? You know, you wouldn't have to be a medical expert to say no. That's not how things work. Sickness, we understand, sin works in exactly the same way. The good health of a well person does not get transferred. And so here we see an insight into the underlying human condition. The underlying human condition of sin means that even if God's people are doing something that could be called sort of holy on the outside, useful deeds, work, useful activity, stuff that generally looks good, then those deeds can't be sort of transferred onto other things like they should affect other things. Let's think about what this might mean for us as we sort of zip forward 2,500 years. I think it is very easy for us as God's people today to take our eye off the Lord and start relying on our own strength. Even as quite mature Christians, I think it's quite easy just to sort of go through the motions a little bit. Can work out a little bit like sort of earning loyalty points on God's building project scheme. Let me try and illustrate this if I can. Imagine Monday morning, okay, think back to yesterday. It's dark as you wake up, typical sort of Monday morning in January. The alarm goes off and you resist the urge to press snooze again. You've done that a couple of times. You get out of bed and as enthusiastically as you can muster on this Monday morning, you manage to have a coffee and a shower, and you read your Bible. Normally you have a chance to do one out of three. Today, yesterday, you do all three. You cycle to your local train station, You stop at two red lights on the way, not always a given. You know, sometimes you think it's a little bit pointless, a little bit rushed, don't want to miss the train and cause other people difficulty, that sort of thing. But nevertheless, in the tiniest way, even these little bits of recognition, not being at loggerheads with the state, that sort of thing, not unhelpful in terms of commending what we say to be true. On the train, you have an opportunity to give up a seat for an elderly man at your office. You get a chance to nod to the security personnel as you walk in, and you even spend, you remember their name, and you even spend 5 seconds praying for them as you head up in your lift to your desk. That day, yesterday, you meet a few other Christians, you plan to hold a talk in your office. You think, yeah, we want to go a little bit more public with our faith, so we're going to hold a talk this Easter on the resurrection. And you pray with a few other Christians in your office, and you go through that, and you have a successful day. And by the end of the day, you sit down on the train on the way home, and you think, yeah, I've racked up quite a few points on the building project loyalty scheme in front of God. He must be pretty chuffed. And you might not quite think about it like that, but something in your mind triggers something that just makes you think, yeah, I've done all right. And it's easy for us to somehow think that our Christian activity, the words that we speak, the actions that will follow the words that we profess, somehow act as a sort of stamp on our loyalty program in God's eyes. I've got one of those Itsu loyalty cards. I always forget I have it, and so whenever I go to Itsu, I think, I haven't got my stupid loyalty card. If I had it there, you know, slowly over about 3 years, I sort of earn my free thing of noodles. And it's like that, isn't it, when it comes to God? A little bit of sort of activity here and activity there, and we think God owes us. And we think the activity that we've given him can somehow sort of be transferred into other things that we might want. Maybe it will cover over things, the inadequacy that we might show towards our family or our friends. Maybe we think it gives us a sort of license to be rude to our boss from time to time. Maybe drinking too much with a friend. But we need to understand that our attendance at church or our kindness to our colleagues or our honesty on our expenses or our giving to gospel work in and around our church and our offices does not cover up, does not give me an excuse to indulge in a little bit of sin here and there, to behave independently of what God intends his people to be doing. It's so easy, isn't it, just to think that our Christian activity can function like that loyalty card and be exchanged for a bit of a free pass on other responsibilities. I've done this, God will let me off that. Nor, though, will it allow us to manipulate or twist God's arm, that somehow God will bless my efforts in other areas because I've been working hard for him. I'm so crazy to imagine, isn't it, that with my loyalty card nearly full in my head, that one more trip to a lunchtime talk and God will give me that promotion. If I just show a little bit of sort of fervor here, I'm sure he'll give me success in my appraisal or whatever it is. Such a very human way of thinking. And this was what was going on 2,500 years ago with the priests putting right as the people were building. You see, we can't please God with our activity. Stone was going on stone, the structure was beginning to take shape, and yet a problem. Let's come to another principle, though, first, before we get to the solution. So the first sub-point there, holiness can't be transferred. That brings us to the second. Have a look at verse 13. Haggai said, If someone who is unclean by contact with a dead body touches any of these, does it become unclean? The priests answered again, and they said, no. Sorry, that's not what they said at all. They said, yes, it does become unclean. It does. Oh, I thought I knew the text so well I could ad-lib there, but that's not right at all, is it? It does become unclean. You'll see the second principle there on the handout. Uncleanness can be transferred. Uncleanness can be transferred. Now, I guess the point is obvious again and something that we're familiar with. If I change my bike tire on the way to the lunchtime talks, it has happened to me before. It didn't happen today. I got here without having to change it. But if I change my bike tire and my hands get full of sort of grime, which is inevitable from the sort of slimy streets of London, your hands get covered in grime, quite hard to sort of clean, and you sort of, you know, wipe it down on your trousers and hope nobody will notice. But inevitably, as I shake people's hands on the door, what's going to happen? The grit will be transferred. Now, that's never actually happened, but you can get the idea, can't you, of what could happen. And the point is quite different, is quite obvious. You see, what Haggai is doing here is highlighting the contagious nature of Christian inconsistency. If my actions are driven by my own efforts, if they are done to please God, to somehow sort of curry his favor, then this can cause other people real difficulties, can cause Christian brothers and sisters to stumble. I'm aware in my sort of the various ministries that I'm involved in, two or three different individuals who have clearly drifted from the Christian faith in one way or another, still attending church, still attending meetings, but clearly out of step with certain aspects of their lifestyles. And this can be really dangerous in the effect that it can have on other people. It can be hugely discouraging when somebody is behaving this sort of way. Uncleanness can be transferred. It's a really serious thing. Just because somebody's turning up at the meetings and going through the motions and taking communion and saying prayers and joining in with hymns, if something that's happening in their private life being known to a few members of the church family, that can be hugely damaging. Uncleanness can be transferred. But this, of course, is only half the text. As we ponder our own lives and our own failings, Haggai comes crashing in with the wonderful words of grace, and it's, of course, where we need to go. There is a challenge. Beat up is a bit strong, but it's definitely a challenge, isn't it, for us, for our churches, for our situations. But the second point is wonderfully clear: God's grace. We see that in verses 15 to 19. To understand God's grace, we need to understand the timing of how these things are delivered. And I'll try and make this clear and simple as we go. Have a look at verse 15. Haggai says, "Now then," so there's a change in pace. "Now then, consider from this day onward, before stone was placed upon stone in the temple of the Lord, how did you fare?" Okay, remember, Haggai is speaking in real time to the people. And he's saying at this stage, remember, they've been building now for 3 months. They need to think back to the time before they started building. Haggai tells them what it was like then. The verse continues, verse 16 continues. "When one came to a heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw 50 measures, there were but 20. They remembered what life was like before they started building 3 months ago. And they think, well, yeah, come to think of it, food was in short supply. Wine vats were emptier than ever. Things were not good. So, says Haggai, if you can see that things were not good before you started the building, then how are things after you've been building? 3 months into the building project. Well, verse 18. "Consider from this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, since the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider, is there seed in the barn yet? Indeed, the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree have yielded nothing." You can imagine them sort of scratching their heads and thinking, Haggai's just made a very strong point. We've been working like crazy for 3 months now, working and working, very hot sun, all of that. And yeah, come to think of it, things are still pretty bad. They were bad when we started and they're bad now. There's no grapes, there's no olives, there's no real improvement. That's really strange, because we've been doing what God wanted us to do for 3 months now. I mean, you can understand, can't you, the sort of the sentiment, perhaps the realization. You'd expect things to get better. You'd expect things to sort of go well for them, but 3 months of work has yielded no blessing. Until now, this is the wonderful change. Until now, very end of verse 19, from this day, this is the huge turning point. You see this, end of verse 19. "From this day," back in real time, "from this day on, I will bless you." And so God graciously blesses them. But do you see the sort of the wonderful sting in the tail, the wonderful reality of what's going on? It's not because of what they have done. We have to conclude it's in spite of what they have done. You see, grace is very simply being given something that we don't deserve. There was nothing, as Haggai's just laid out, there is nothing in their actions which merited God's blessing. Instead, God chose to pour out his blessing. Just after he'd exposed their sin, he said, "Now I will bless you. It's not because of your work. It's because I have chosen to give freely." You see, our actions do not generate a direct response from God. We cannot twist God's arm. We can't cover over our sins with what we do. We can't expect our good works to earn us credit on our loyalty scheme with God that we've made up in our heads. And we could leave it there. We could stop there. It would be enough in many sense. Like for them, we can trust the Lord to provide richly and abundantly. I mean, they didn't know how God would deal with sin. The temple was giving them some sort of indication. They would have remembered how it would have worked. But it is an important step along the way to our understanding. For us, 2,500 years later, yes, building God's temple is the heartbeat of Haggai. But the challenge from this third sermon, as you build, as we go about the temple building that we're involved in, the spiritual house that every single Christian has been commissioned to be part of, are you building in the Lord's strength or in your own? Grace is God's free gift of righteousness, and it's available to anyone who will accept Jesus' sacrifice. There's nothing that you've done. There's no part of your life, however brilliant your activity for God has been, there's no part that's earned you any success. Any success is down to God's grace. You see, sin is like a spiritual cancer that devours our soul. We must let Jesus deal with this horrible uncleanness. It is interesting, as you just go through the Bible timeline very, very quickly, 500 years forward, and of course Jesus enters the scene, and there's that wonderful meal that Jesus shares with his disciples the night before the cross. It's just on the verge of on the eve of the Passover. And Jesus explained that he's going to love them by going to the cross, wash their unclean hearts to deal with sin. And Peter doesn't like the idea of this. Do you remember Jesus even sort of tries to illustrate this by washing Peter's feet? And he says, "No, Jesus, you won't wash me." And Jesus says, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." It's our natural reaction as human beings, isn't it? We want to do it ourselves. "No, Jesus, really, I'll do this." But there is no other way to deal with this horrible infectious disease. On the cross, Jesus' death is the only way. That's how grace is given. The peoples in Haggai's day needed to learn this. They needed to see how serious sin was so that they would rely fully on God and see that his blessing was not deserved. See, no good service or work of my hands could ever deal with something so serious. It turns and runs right to the very core of our being. It will necessarily affect everything, even my so-called sort of useful things. Only God's grace through the cross of Jesus is useful. And that's where our motivation comes. So there's the challenge. I mean, we need to sort of ditch our own strength and subsistence. We're so good at relying on ourselves and our routines and our sort of whatever it is that gets us up in the morning and charges us through the day. Those things aren't bad, but they're disastrous if they're on your own strength. Instead, God's grace, the cross, everything necessary, draw on that strength. There's our motivation. There's a few things to think about as we finish our time. I put a few questions there at the bottom of the handout. You may just want to bounce around if you've got a few moments.